This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, sitting in for Terry Gross. Before we get into today's Veterans Day show, we want to note the passing of singer, songwriter, and poet Leonard Cohen, who has died at the age of 82. Terry interviewed Leonard Cohen in 2006, and we played that interview 3 weeks ago when his new album, You Want It Darker, was released. We'll rebroadcast that same interview again in 2 weeks, on the Friday after Thanksgiving. Meanwhile, today, on Veterans Day, we reflect on the consequences of war and honor those who have served in the armed forces. We're going to observe the day by listening back to interviews in our archives with vets who have risked their lives in Iraq and in Europe during the Second World War. Being exposed to IEDs, improvised explosive devices, and car bombs of every sort was a way of life for our first guest, Brian Kastner. He was the commander of an EOD unit in Iraq. EOD stands for Explosive Ordnance Disposal. His unit's mission was to clear roads, cities, and buildings of IEDs, to find and blow up weapon stockpiles squirreled away throughout the country, and to collect evidence from blast scenes to track down and kill the bomb makers. He had robots to defuse IEDs, but when the robots couldn't get the job done, one of his men had to put on the 80-pound protective Kevlar suit and do the long walk to the bomb, the real version of what was depicted in the film The Hurt Locker. Brian Kastner was an officer in the U.S. Air Force from December 1999 to September 2007 and wrote about commanding the EOD in his memoir, The Long Walk. He spoke with Terry in 2012.
Brian Kastner, welcome to Fresh Air. A lot of our listeners will know about the work that you did through the movie The Hurt Locker, which I'm sure had some truth and fiction mixed together about the job. But, you know, the most dramatic thing in that film was when somebody had to put on, like, the suit, the 80-pound Kevlar suit, and do, you know, the long walk to the actual bomb and then try to disassemble the bomb before it exploded. Did you ever have to wear the suit and do the walk?
You know, I never did. And as an officer and in command of the unit, I went on lots and lots of missions, but it was definitely the team leader, the specialist who has done nothing but the technical aspect of the job for a decade. You know, it was his job to put on the suit. So I put guys in suits all the time, and I gave them the approval to put on the suit and go down nearly every day, every other day. And it is certainly the longest, loneliest walk that you will ever take. For an EOD guy who is used to being in control and accomplishing the mission, it is certainly more terrifying to be the one in the suit, but not having the sense of control to be able to do the one used to just, you know, drive me nuts to have to watch them walk down. And really, neither I nor anybody else can help them in that moment.
Did any of the men you work with actually get killed wearing the suit and doing the long walk to disassemble a bomb?
I was extremely lucky. So nobody under my direct command did while I was commanding them or while I was in charge. I have lost a lot of friends who were in the suit. I've lost a lot of friends who were not in the suit because they never had a chance to put it on because something blew them up that they didn't see. But I consider myself extremely fortunate that I was never in the position of saying, yeah, it's time to put it on, and then to see him turn into that pink mist cloud.
What did you wear yourself?
When we got started in Iraq, guys were putting on all sorts of combinations of hillbilly armor, we called it. You bolted on metal plates to the side of your soft-skinned Humvee. And eventually the armor got so good. Guys are really surviving blasts that they never would have before. And when I just went down in May to the EOD Memorial, we have a memorial in Florida in Fort Walton Beach, and there's a wall set up where we put all of the names of the guys who died in the last year. We have the annual ceremony in May, and then all of the names for everyone since World War II is on there. And when you go to that ceremony, what strikes you is not just the number of names that we're putting on, which was 18 last year, which was the most since 1945, but then also that the other guys who are there attending, the number of people that have missing limbs, missing arms, missing legs, they probably would have died in previous wars, but the medical apparatus or infrastructure, I should say, that we have now is so good. People are losing multiple limbs and they're coming home alive.
Let's talk about one of the worst days for your group. And that was the day you describe as the day of the six VBEDs. And VBED is a VBIED, that's a vehicle-borne IED. So is that a car bomb that we're talking about? Is that basically a car bomb?
It is. Of course, the military has an acronym for everything.
Yes.
And so there were many kinds of IEDs, and they would just put different letters in front of them to differentiate. But car bomb is exactly right. We had six in 15 minutes. Five of them detonated and one did not.
Okay, so that was a bad day, the day of the six car bombs. But you say the next day was even worse. Describe what happened the next day.
We actually had 3 days that were really bad. And this might tell you something about the nature of memory or how mixed up it all was in my mind. I didn't realize that these 3 days happened in succession until the book was nearly done and I was looking through some of my old journals. But on the first day, we did a raid on what we thought was an EFP factory, and it turned out not to be, in an Arab part of town. The next day, we had the day of six V-beds. And then the third day, we were so amped up and ready for more that we had another V-bed, but it never felt right from the beginning. A vehicle rammed a U.S. convoy, which was not their normal tactic. And when the team got out there, Trey, who was the team leader, he's a reservist, he's a cop. He's got a lot of experience in dealing with crowds and stressful situations, but I could tell something wasn't right. He was taking a lot of gunfire. It happened at this central roundabout just south of Kirkuk where a lot of different highways come in. So he was extremely exposed, getting shot at a lot. And as he was trying to take this bomb apart, he realized that the driver who was shot wasn't dead. And more than the fact that he wasn't dead, he refused to get out of the truck. And so we got to a point, which is the situation that you really don't want to see or that we dread seeing, which is that one of our explosive tools, which is supposed to be used to disassemble a bomb to make it safe, we were going to be in the position of having to use it on a person. If he didn't get out of the truck, we were going to have to blow it up with him in it.
Why couldn't you just drag him out of the truck?
Well, that would involve taking the long walk again. And in fact, Trey went up and tried. He thought maybe the individual was pinned and couldn't get out of the truck. He didn't follow the commands of the interpreter, and he started putting his hands up underneath his clothing to activate what Trey thought was a bomb, so we had to shoot him. And as it turns out, there was nothing on him. Decisions.
The thing he was reaching for apparently was his Quran.
Correct. He was. Why was he walking to the crowd without stopping? Why was he reaching for it? I don't know. Was he planning on stopping to pray at that moment? I simply don't know.
My impression from the book is that this experience really weighed on you because you had to give the command to shoot him. And it's something you really didn't want to do, is my impression. You called your captain and asked him, what do we do? We don't want to kill this guy, but he's not going to get out of the car. And the captain told you that, well, military had already tried to kill him and shot him at least once. So, you know, basically do what you have to do. But then he gets out of the car and you have to give the order to shoot. At the risk of stating, of asking the obvious, why has that weighed on you so much?
It has not weighed on me because we made a mistake, because mistakes happen in wartime. Everybody's just doing the best they can to survive every day. And so I don't regret it from that from that perspective, I felt like I wanted to give Trey the cover to do what he needed to do because I felt like that was my responsibility. If something bad happened, I wanted to make it, I wanted to have whatever was going to happen land on me instead of him. If there was an investigation or if there was some sort of wrongful death inquiry, I wanted them to come talk to me. But what really bothered me about that situation was I had told myself that what we were doing in Iraq was keeping everyone alive. We kept U.S. soldiers alive. We kept Iraqis alive. We took apart every single bomb, and it didn't matter who the target was. It didn't matter if it was going to blow up an Iraqi school or a U.S. convoy. You take them all apart. And in this situation, we were going to use our explosives to kill somebody instead of, you know, making Iraq just a little bit safer.
How many blasts would you say approximately that you were near in Iraq?
I have about 5 or 10 that I would say I was way too close. And then I have another couple dozen that were probably too close enough that they did a little bit of brain damage. And then on average, we would blow something up or something would blow us up about 2 or 3 times a day. So I guess the total number is it's in the hundreds. It's maybe 1,000.
Wow. So you always thought you were lucky for surviving. You had your limbs, nothing blown off, no blood, no wounds. But after you came home, you realized the kind of permanent damage that exposure, sometimes very close exposure, to all those blasts had really caused. What's your understanding now of how exposure to those explosions affects your brain?
So there's been a lot of new research, and this is not something that anybody could have told me 10 years ago because we didn't have the research to tell us this because so much of it is so recent, that your brain is damaged by simply being close to an explosion. And there's really 2 kinds of brain damage when you think about traumatic brain injury, TBI, which is a bit of a buzzword now. Fortunately, people are becoming more aware of it. There's the concussion problem, which is what happens to football players and hockey players and boxers, and it happens to soldiers too. And that's when your brain comes to a sudden stop and smushes on the inside of your skull. And that happens in traffic accidents and such. But then there's a more insidious part, which is that explosive waves are a lot like sound waves. They're compression waves. And so when they travel through a medium, they speed up or slow down depending on how dense that medium is. So they move relatively slowly through the air, and then they speed up, say, through the wall, or they speed up through a car. They also speed up through your head. Anywhere that there's a change in density, there's going to be sheer ripping forces and tearing forces. Every nerve ending and little fiber and little bump and nodule starts moving at a different speed as that blast wave moves through your head. And so you tear things internally. And if you go through a single traumatic event, if you step on a landmine or an IED and you lose your leg and that detonation is so close, you can have a single instantaneous traumatic event that does a lot of damage. But if you blow something up every day, it's more like occupational exposure. It's like playing guitar too loud in a band for years, except you're not just losing your hearing, you're losing short-term memories, you're losing long-term memories, you're losing the ability to make decisions. There's sleep apnea problems that come from it, a lot of sleep disorders. There's just a lot of little insidious things, and it's a spectrum of problems, and I'm very lucky that I'm on one end, but all of my brothers in the EOD world, we all have some variety of this from having blown so many things up over the years.
Before you went to Iraq, you wrote a letter to your sons in case you didn't make it home, and you say that that letter is in a safe in your home You haven't read it since you've gotten back, and you don't even remember what you wrote. So I guess I'm wondering why you kept it, and yet why you haven't read it.
You know, as a bomb tech, you don't spend a lot of your life being scared, but I'm scared to read that letter. I don't want to read it because I don't know what I put in, and I'm afraid that it's going to just be full of bravado and flag and country, and this is my great purpose, and a lot of the things that I felt that just don't make a lot of sense anymore. I kept it because it is honestly who I was. And either when my sons are older or after I'm gone, it'll give some insight, I suppose. I feel like I can't throw it out unless I read it first. And since I'm too scared to read it, it's still sitting there.
Well, Brian Kastner, I really want to thank you doubly. Thank you for this interview and for all you've told us. Thank you for your service to the country. Thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been an honor to speak to you.
Brian Kastner led an explosive ordnance disposal unit in Iraq. He was on Fresh Air in 2012 after his memoir, The Long Walk, was published. His new book is about the death of his friend Matt Schwartz, who was also an EOD technician and who was killed in Afghanistan by a roadside bomb. The new book is called All the Ways We Kill and Die. About the letter Kastner wrote to his sons before he was deployed to Iraq, he tells us that he ran across it the other day. It is still in his safe, and it is still unopened.